This is a WSMI podcast from the Tally Broadcasting Station.
All right, I promised, and here he is, Roger Cradiville, in the studio, in our temporary studio. I think the last five or six times you've been here, you've been in a lot bigger rooms than this, but...
Cozy.
Yeah, it's cozy, all right. Hopefully I don't make you too hot. It is a great afternoon anytime we're above, and right now it's even better because we got Roger in here. Roger is one of my favorite local historians because... he is old enough to experience a lot of it and smart enough to what he didn't experience to maybe research it a little bit. So that's pretty worthwhile. You've got something coming up, though, that I know is hot on your mind and we should talk about. And that is, of course, talking about this Verdon mine disaster and this event coming up in May.
Yeah, it's first Saturday in May. There's going to be an honoring of my grandfather, George Simberger, who was a veteran of the Verdon riot in 1898, he was injured. He was shot through the ankle and was incapacitated for a short while. Probably a month or two ago, Nelson Gurman, who's very much involved with the miners in Mount Olive and the monument, etc., called and said they wanted to honor him, and then I think they're going to honor also the auxiliary members of the miners. The miners, the women belong to the auxiliary, and then, of course, the miners belong to the union and the coal miners union. But, yeah, I'm very happy about that. His grave is probably within 100 feet of the monument of Mother Jones. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to walk over to his gravesite and talk about him. It was an interesting story, you know, because he died. He not only lived in the mines, he died in the mines. He was 75 years old, I believe, when he died of a heart attack in the mines, still working.
In the mine, okay.
Yeah, still working. Those people didn't make much money in the mine because the mines didn't always work. A lot of times they shut down during the summers, so they had to work as long as they could. And, of course, he had 11 children, of which the mother died on the birth of the 11th child. So that put the family in a real big quandary. In fact, just this morning I was reading the obituary. I hadn't read it in years, a lot of years, and read the obituary of when he died. And like I said, he was a longtime member of the fire department. They tell me he went to almost every funeral in town, regardless what it was. He was very much involved with the Catholic Church in Mount Olive. Was a good community member, actually a longtime member of the fire department, which, as you might have heard before, that a lot of those early organizations were closed only to a certain nationality.
Really?
Yeah,
okay.
And Turner Hall was like that in Mount Olive. The fire department was like that in Mount Olive, where they would have two no votes. And if you were a non-German and you wanted to get in one of those organizations, the two no votes would keep you from getting in.
Really?
Now, today we look at that as really what, you know, very much interest because of today's politics, but at that time was normal. Everything was closed circuit. Liederkranz Choir was a large choir in town, all Germans. Yeah. And the coal mines, early ones, were organized for German coal miners. In fact, that's how a lot of your Croatians, Slovaks, Bohemians, Serbians, that's how they all came to town. They were around 1900. They were brought in to break up the German cliques that were in the mine. So, and my grandfather Simberger, you know, George Simberger, that's a good German name, and he would have probably been of that feeling, you know, that the Germans were first, and then everything else came after that.
I'll be darned. That's interesting. The Verdon mine event. I don't know that everybody knows exactly what happened there. That was a traumatic thing.
Absolutely. My good friend John Alexander over at Verdon is an expert on the Verdon riot. I mean, he has a library, I think he has a bookstore or something in town there and in Springfield. But anyway, he and I have worked together over the years because colleges used to bring labor classes to Mount Olive, and I would talk to them library, then take them on a tour of the cemetery. And it was a two-pronged thing. In other words, they would start or end in Verdon, or then come to Malabar, or vice versa. And we would give them a complete picture of this information. You know, an interesting sideline on this thing, particularly in Mount Olive, I'm not so sure about other towns, but the young people in Mount Olive are very well versed on the Verdon riot and on Mother Jones. And you might say to yourself, well, it involves Mount Olive. They should know it. That's not necessarily always so. They don't always teach this. You know, I know when I taught history, I spent 2 weeks on Mount Olive history because I wanted the kids to know where they came from. You know, the old line, how do you know where you're going if you don't know where you came from? That was a strong feeling in my mind, so I taught them for two weeks of strictly Mount Olive history. And I started that only because I got tired of kids saying, hey, I can't wait to get out of here. You know, I can't wait to go someplace else. I mean, Mount Olive has nothing. And I wanted to show them that they have something. You know, farmer this, farmer vice president of New York Stock Exchange for Mount Olive, farmer this, farmer that. And so the Verdon riot, which you started with here, is pretty knowledgeable among the kids. For years, I used to, the lower grade teachers would ask me to go out to the cemetery with them and talk to the kids about Mother Jones. And I would, of course, ask questions. You know, they knew the answers. The teachers were very good at doing this here. We have a teacher, Julie Brown Cavity, who's very much involved with pushing the model. In fact, she's a member of, I believe, the board or the museum board, you know, in Mount Olive. And that's, you know, the history of this is very familiar to the kids up there, and it makes it easier for me because it is being continued on.
A casual person, whether it's a person driving on the interstate and they see the green sign that says Mother Jones Monument ahead, or maybe they maybe just moved to the area and heard somebody say there's a Mother Jones Monument, and they may think that Mother Jones was herself from Mount Olive, and nothing's farther from the truth. But she wound up there.
She's bigger.
A lot bigger than just Mount Olive.
Yeah, right. She's really big. She just went into the Labor Hall of Fame in Washington a couple of years ago, and she's recognized every place as a leader, well, particularly in women's rights. You know, when women's rights became very prominent in the last 20, 30, 40 years, where they've really been pushing this with equal pay, equal, et cetera, which it should be, by the way. Her name comes forward because she was a gutsy woman. She's 5 feet four, weighed 104 pounds.
She has a national worldwide magazine named after her.
You know, when Martin Luther King was moving the civil rights movement throughout the country, you know, he spent a lot of time in jail. Mother Jones spent a lot of time in jail. She was a crusty old woman. Looks like everybody's grandma, you know, but had a great history, and most of her history is in her latter part of her life. Her early history is sad. I mean, she lost her husband, all her kids, in an epidemic in down in Memphis, Tennessee. And there's a period of her time in her 100 years that she nobody knows anything about. They don't know if she disappeared or what happened to her. They just nothing there. And in her latter years, you know, she chose to be buried in Mount Olive. And the reason for that has to go where she started here, Verdon riot. That's where she called them her boys, because
right.
They were brave boys. I mean, you think about today, how many, you know, if you got up in Litchfield or Mount Olive Hillsboro and stuff, you go up there and say, we need about 20 and 30. We're going to go over to Verdon and bring your guns. We're going to sit there and we're going to keep scabs or strike breakers or whatever you want to call them from trying to break the union. Okay. Well, how many do you think you'd get? If you look at the monument at Mount Olive, it's not just Mother Jones's name there. There are names of umpteen other people from West Frankfort and Southern Illinois and so on who died trying to defend, you know, labor rights, union rights, coal miners' rights. And I know my dad told me one time that him and two or three other guys just got a new car. They said, hey, let's go down to Franklin County. They need help down there in the strike. My gosh. The sheriff's department and you know, and everybody else was all on the side of the owners of the mine. And they directed the car my dad was in into a field, and they opened up on them with guns. Nobody got hurt, fortunately, but I know they made a U-turn, and they came home with a lot of air conditioning in the car because apparently there was a lot of holes in that car. That's not unusual.
Roger Cradiville, our guest here this afternoon, talking about the Verdon mine disaster and a special event that's going to be taking place the first Saturday in May commemorating a number of things that happened then. In Mount Olive this week, Roger, the 101st Macoupin County Basketball Tournament. It's ironic that, A, it's been around that long, and you're here, and it's in Mount Olive this week.
Yeah, it's great. 101 years, that's a long time. Actually, Mount Olive had basketball before 1920, or 1919, when it started. But what's kind of unique about sports is that, you know, in our times today, we're having real big trouble in small schools and field teams. I think the only basic teams that are in Mount Olive right now that are strictly Mount Olive kids is boys basketball, which happened to be one of them now, boys baseball, and girls volleyball. And, of course, we have a fishing team, which is, and we have a golf team. There's not very many kids in those, but those, I believe, are all Mount Olive kids. But the basketball tournament has been around a long time. I understand it's the second oldest one in the United States.
Is that right?
Second longest one. And it's really a classic. You know, when I was growing up, when I was in high school, for instance, you know, the chances, and even around here, you think about teams. How many teams get past the regional in basketball?
When it was one class, they didn't.
Yeah, when it was one class, you just didn't do that. I mean, you got your Nokomis is traditionally good, and a few others. You could add them yourself. But the point is that the county tournament was something that you could win. You know, and Mount Olive, until the late 1900s, Mount Olive had the second most championships. Now, since that time, it's been pretty slim, and I think we've won one. In fact, since 1949, we haven't won too many of them. So the point I'm getting at is that we're like fourth or fifth. We have more championships than Carlinville or Bunker Hill or Girard or Ferd and all those towns up there. But you don't think of Mount Olive as basketball right now. I mean, you think of it as other sports, and you know, you name them yourself. But the thing is, it's a unique sport. I think the state tournament has every school, including Little Ohio, has a basketball team, and little towns can play basketball if they get enough kids. The individual sports usually survive on their own because they don't need a team; they need individuals. You know, you have two kids going to state and track, you got a good team.
Yeah.
You know, you got a couple kids going to state and wrestling, you've got a good team. And so on. Now you want more, but the thing is you're still going to be successful with limit. But you gotta have 5 in basketball, you gotta have 11 in football or more in baseball, 9, etc. And so right now the uniqueness of this tournament is showing, and everybody has a chance. I personally looked at the records. I'm not so sure anybody's got a winning record in the Macoupin County. I may be wrong, and I apologize to whoever has a winning record, but usually you always had the certain teams that just stood out. Now, anybody that follows the history of basketball knows that Gillespie's probably going to be number one. Gillespie had a bunch, just like Southwestern and the girls. You know, they won 18 of them or something. I mean, a lot of them. So those teams are always going to stand out. They team after team after team that were good, you know. But my 4 years of high school, the worst record we had in my 4 years was 17-9. Now that you're a champion now in the year of being 17-9. Our best record was 23-2. We beat Litchfield in a double overtime and lost to Hillsborough in an overtime, and Hillsborough went to state. This was in 1953. And Manal that year won all football, basketball, baseball, track. Only time in the history of South Central anybody's won all 4 sports championships. But, again, same kids. You know, I mean, you had maybe a pool of 15 kids. You know, played everything. You know, you didn't have trouble with kids cootie. You know, they stuck it out. And I think that's the key you got right now. You know, everybody's having trouble fielding teams, period. I mean, look at all the changes.
It's not just fielding the teams. They're having a hard time getting officials to cover these games in every sport. I was thinking the other day, I'd watched, of course, I was there all day for Terry's shootout, and a lot of officials, you know, worked that day. Some of them worked a couple of games, but I thought, I've never seen so many officials, different people, at one location before, because I'm surprised there were that many almost. Louis Lang, you know, talks about it all the time, about how difficult it is to get young fellows interested in being an official. But we got to have them or the games don't go on.
See, there's two ways that you look at getting officials. One is obviously a love of the sport. I refereed football, basketball, and baseball. Excuse me. Baseball only 1 year when they dropped it about, I was making $125 a year coaching baseball, and they dropped the sport because they couldn't afford it. Oh. That's a true story, 1965.
Oh, my.
But the thing is that the other reason is it's spending money. I mean, they get pretty good money now. I mean,
sure.
That was my spending money when I was growing. Now, I coached football, basketball, baseball, you know, over the years, but not only about 5 years, all three of them, you know, all three of them at the same time. So you always had a season off. So I would work football. It's kind of a funny story about football refereeing. My first year teaching, I just got my license. I never had any experience at all. Chuck Hines was the football coach at Bonhomme, and he also refereed. So he said, hey, what are you doing tonight? I'm first year. In fact, I've been teaching 2 months. He goes, what are you doing tonight? I said, nothing. He said, hey, we're going to Robinson. They need an official, or we need an official. So you and I and one other guy, we're going to Robinson, Illinois. Drove all the way over there to referee a football game, and I just got my license as a referee. And first call I blew. I found out why referees put their whistle on their finger. There is a reason for that. So they don't blow it by mistake.
Unintentionally,
yeah. A guy moves on the line, what's your first reaction? Blowing a whistle. Well, you put it in your finger, your first reaction is nothing, and that's what you don't want to do. But as funny as it was, that first game, nobody heard my whistle. So I just let the game continue on. But I blew my whistle. Should have killed the game. So I was probably violating the rules in my first darn game I refereed. But I worked a lot of games with a lot of people. Some of the fans were interesting. One time I was working a game at I worked a lot of grade school games because they could never get grade school officials. And I worked games, and so often, no matter where you went to, if you went to a Litchfield game, there were Litchfield officials. You went to Glisby, there were Glisby or Penelope. And I was from Monolive, so I was working at Monolive game. I mean, we're all honest. I mean, we weren't trying to cheat or steal the game, play the game. We'll see how it come out. And I know Judge Vertick, I kidded him about this for years and years and years. The game was tight. And the judge is a good friend of mine. Don't worry about his son's family's good friends too. So I told his son this one time. I said, you know, your dad was really hot because he's passed away now. I said, boy, he was always hot in these games. And he wrote me a letter one time on onion skin. I'll always remember that. Wrote me this letter criticizing me, but complimenting me for doing the job on it. And then ended it by saying, the reason I'm writing this letter, because my wife said if I don't send this letter, she's not talking to me again. So I'm writing this letter in self-defense. But I always thought that was a funny story. But, you know, people get involved in these games. You know, listen to your games when the announcer, public address announcer comes out. You know, let the referees referee, let the fans play, let the players play. You know, they got these lines they got to give you. Because there's always people being drawn. I think Glisby had a couple people barred this year from a game for football, basketball, whatever it is. And my son's a principal of Pawnee High School and Pawnee Junior High School. Ever so often, some of these fans get overexcited. It's tough to take heat when you're not getting paid that much. Although varsity officials, many of them get $100. You work. Where else are you going to work an hour and a half for $100?
Yeah, that's
true. If you can put up with it.
Yeah, and make the drive and handle the weather. That's for sure.
I had a friend of mine. I won't mention her name, but two guys refereed in the area when I was coaching, and they drove a propane car. Fuel, so they were there for the purpose of saving money. So then they'd get their checks, then go over to Poulos Tavern in White City and just cash their check and spend it there. And they were driving a propane car to save money. I'll never forget that.
Roger Cradiville, our guest, talking about all things. Let me ask, John L. Lewis was also a contemporary of Mother Jones, right?
Right. In the beginning.
The question I have that I've always wondered about it, when I've read everything I've read about Mother Jones, from the plaques there at the Union Miner Cemetery, from the things I've read online, everything lends to this woman had an incredible passion for the working man, and she wanted to create fairness in everything that was going on. I mean, was she that self-focused?
Yeah, you remember her quote, you know, I'm not a humanitarian. I'm a hellraiser.
Yeah, that's
That's
right.
What she said. And that was her quote. She never, you know, her, you might wonder, how did she make a living? I mean, who paid her? United Mine Workers paid her a good part of those years. They paid her even though she didn't agree with John L. Lewis and anybody else at the time. Now, yeah. John L. Lewis has a background here, you know, or Panama. He has a background there. I understand. I heard one time that his housekeeper was a lady who worked at the Hut in Litchfield, which
really?
That great little restaurant by the tracks.
Sure,
made pies there. That I can't say that's true, but I've heard that story before. But yeah, Mother Jones' compassion wasn't so much for more money as it was for working conditions. See, that's the thing that people have to remember. That the working conditions were so poor for workers, particularly in coal miners, because you had absolutely no power, none except collectively. You know, if you would work together, strike, what have you, then you had some power. But individually, you didn't have any power. And Mother Jones understood this, but she geared mostly towards child labor. That's where she was upset that these factories and these mines would have kids. Keep in mind, in the early days of coal mining, your hat had a candle on it. It was before carbide lamp.
Yeah.
You put a young kid, everybody went to mine at 14 or 13 because the fathers were paid by the carload of coal. So if you had three kids helping you, you might fill up five cars instead of two by yourself.
And
so that's
the,
why they did it.
The little kids who were short, they had a certain job because they were short enough
right.
that they could do it. And I forget what they call them. I knew one time, but. That's fascinating. And so I understand the working conditions.
Yeah, that was the key thing for her. She actually was most impressed by the young kids who worked in factories who lost limbs, lost an arm or a leg due to dangerous occupations. I worked in the steel mill when I was in college, high school. There's 100 ways you can get hurt in the steel mill. Just take your choice. Mm. If you don't get hurt, you're lucky. Well, think about years ago with kids working in these, spin mills and all these different and coal mines too, of course. And so she paraded a whole bunch of. I don't know how she got them organized, but Teddy Roosevelt was president of the United States at that time, and he had a summer home in New York, and so she paraded them around there. Can you see CNN today and Fox Television and all these different television networks being out there compared to those days? All you had was the Hearst newspapers
that
advertised everything. And most people believe what the Hearst newspaper said. And like I said, somebody said that helped create the Spanish-American War, thanks to William Randolph Hearst. But that's what she did. And she brought attention to this. Well, you know the newspaper titled her the Most Dangerous Woman in America.
Really?
Yeah, that was the title. She was listed in the New York papers as the most dangerous woman in America.
Wow.
So think of that compared to, like I said, Martin Luther King and some of the other people who promoted civil rights or had a parade around in different very dangerous areas because nobody was going to accept her. Remember, it's also a lot of people fed her. That's when she moved from town to town. They would feed her. You know, she was in Mount Olive several times. My mother told me she met her. She was a spitting, cussing old lady. He's my mom called. My mom lived to be 90, almost 97. So she had met her in there, and she said she'd go in the bars with the men because, you know, women weren't necessarily allowed in the bars except certain type of women at that time in the description by other women. And that is that she would go in there with them and have a shot and a beer, what they call a boiler maker.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of her life.
That's incredible. And did all this at a time when there was no government support of any kind. It wasn't like you could count on somebody to come in like the FBI or somebody or a SWAT team to protect you. You know, you started a fight or for what you thought was right. You were there by yourself and whoever you had around you to defend with you.
Well, you know, the National Guard is a very respected, strong part of the military. It's spent a lot of National Guard people have fought in the Middle East of recent years. But when I was in high school, when the National Guard came out recruiting people in school, and they would do that because you could start the National Guard at 17 or something, and you could get a year or two before you even got out of high school. And my dad said, you ever join that, you just leave the house. Because whenever they had a strike, the first thing the old mine owners did was call out, either the county departments, the sheriff's department. Now, there were a lot of respect to the sheriff's department, but some of the sheriff's department, and particularly the southern part of the state, were in cahoots with the owners of the mine, as well as the National Guard. They would call out the National Guard. See, Mount Olive, at one time, wouldn't ship coal. In the 1890s, wouldn't ship coal for the coal mines. And so Jay Gould, who was the owner of the railroads, tried to get the government involved. So the president ordered the military to and they bivouacked on the Zion Lutheran Church grounds, which is right by the tracks of Mount Olive Main Street. It's not a church anymore, but it was a church for 150 years or so, 100-something years. Anyway, they bivouacked there. But they wouldn't go out and find them because the farmers hid all the miners that were on strike and wouldn't sell that coal to Jay Gould. Kind of an interesting sidelight story about that. Jay Gould, the people, the coal miners in Mount Olive, the German coal miners, wanted a railroad spur through Mount Olive and to ship the coal. And Jay Gould said, okay, I'll give you a spur if you give me free coal for my engines. The conservative Germans in Mount Olive said no. So what they did is they built their own railroad. Started Mount Olive, ran it to the south of Mount Olive, tied up with one of the major trains of major railroads, and that's how they shipped their coal out of town up there. But there were three railroads. Actually, four railroads went through Mount Olive at one time.
Wow.
I mean, it's quite a bit. You know, Norfolk Western, Illinois Central, Litchfield and Madison, and the transit system, which was a trolley. Okay.
A number of years ago, I was visiting with a lady, and I don't remember if she was in Benilde or Sawyerville. She was probably, at that time, and I'm talking 15, 20 years ago, she was probably in her mid-70s. And she said, I want to show you something. We walked out in the backyard, and there was a little stone building that looked like it was one room. It had a door that looked like the door to a castle. It had a block knocked out of the concrete block wall for a window. And she said, this is a jail. And she said, Al Capone spent a night here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember if it was Sawyerville or Benilde City Jail, but it was an amazing thing. And it went inside. And I mean, literally, it was as wide as my shoulders hallway. And it had two jail cells. And the cots were literally would swing down. They were bolted into the concrete block wall, and I guess they threw a tick mattress on top of it, had a bucket to go to the bathroom, and that was it. That was the jail. Does that?
Oh, yeah.
You remember that?
Every little town had one. White City had one. White City had their own. But our jail was right there on Main Street where the Stephanie's restaurant is at. There was a jail back there. But in White City, they had a little building there. Just as you're going on 138 between, White, Mount Auburn, Bunnell, on the left-hand side of it, it was a wooden building. I have the key to that jail.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I gave it to the police department in Mount Olive as a relic so they could key. You know, it's like the Barney Fife, the big key they put in there, That had the key. But it was also the electrician's shop because the power in White City was provided by the 15 coal mine. White City got all their power from the mine, and so did Mount Olive. And kind of a sideline, you've probably heard this before, but in December, they gave you a free month. You didn't have to pay for electricity in February. But anyway, the electrical shop was also in the jail. So the guy slept there. Wouldn't there be something you could put together to break out, They just never broke out. Because where would they go when you think about it?
Yeah.
Because most of those towns had a policeman. It's like, one day you're this, and the next day you're a cop. You take your T-shirt, you put a badge on it, now you're a policeman. And because most of those little towns, including Bunnell, took care of their own problems. I mean, you had trouble. You didn't need a policeman. You had 40 guys there waiting for you. That wasn't unusual in all them small towns. But in Bunnell, it was definitely. Because Bunnell was a kind of a tough town at one time. It has a lot of character. Bunnell is one of my favorite towns. I know a lot of people there and good friends with a lot of them. And it's got a lot of character, if that's the best way to say it.
I was talking earlier before you came in about an event that's coming up Sunday the 27th at the Moose Club in Litchfield. A lot of musicians, a lot of them in the St. Louis area, that have played at the Coliseum are getting together for just kind of a reunion and a reminder and a little chance to maybe play. And have some nice conversations about their times at the Coliseum, because let's face it, that was a famous, famous place and a magnet for not only local bands but touring bands. And Joyce was a character as well as all her family.
Well, Eddie Ebert is, I just wrote a story on him about 2 months ago. And Eddie Ebert, in fact, I just saw him today and talked to him. He had a band. He was in a band there. And I wrote a whole column on it for the Buzz and so on. And it was a great character place. I had more fun at Taro's. And I used to joke people, if you could reach above the bar, you could get a drink there. You didn't have to be 21. But it was so much fun there, you know, a place to go. Where do kids go today? You know, where can you go other than you find an empty lot down? They'll sit there, you know, talking to each other at night. And a lot of the adults don't care for that either if they leave one paper cup laid on the ground. You know, so, I mean, there's a story behind that, too. But that was a great part of history. I only went to Terrell's from my junior year in high school to my first year teaching here because when I started teaching, I was a coach, and I'd go there and half my players were there.
Yeah, you couldn't hang out.
Yeah, the old line is, what you don't see, you don't hurt you, you know, so. And it's always been that way, but it was a great place in the era. That, in fact, I met my wife there.
Yeah,
yeah. So
my wife told me that she said out of time she was 18 years old, you know, up through early 20s, said every Saturday night to the Guild, you know, at the Coliseum because they played there all the time, you know, at the end.
Right.
And poor Dave Boone, who recently passed. Of course, he was the last guy who really had that going and booked the entertainment there and kept the Guild, kept the Coliseum going.
Well, annually, Glisby, they put together a celebration, a remembrance of Terrell's.
Right.
I've been to it the first time, couldn't make it the second time, but I intend on going. That's a lot of fun, a lot of memory. They brought members of the Guild back that were survivors, I guess, at one time, and it's just a great history. Well, you know, there is, I don't know if you ever heard of RFD Television.
Oh, sure.
RFD Television has Molly B and the Polka group. They play there, you know, and I'm kind of a fan of that because that's where I grew up my days in White City.
Oh, of course.
So I'll poke at that. Well, she's coming to Mount Olive in April. She's going to have her group there, and they're going to perform at the Catholic Church, and I don't need to advertise them, but it's coming, and anybody who's interested in that sort of stuff can follow up and see if they want to go to it. I'll be there.
Hey, when I was a kid, again, we all know I'm old. When I was a kid, I went to a lot of half round, half square dances at the Sacred Heart Church in Oconee at their community center. So, yeah, I know about the polka bands. And all our folks watched, and you too, I'm sure, watch Lawrence Welk.
Oh, yeah. That was a typical Saturday night, you know, watch it on television.
And I can still sit here and give you the lineup. It was Joanne Castle and Myron Cohen, and I forget who the two dancers were, but, you know, we always had that.
The Lennon Sisters.
Oh, the Lennon Sisters, too,
yeah,
of course.
Because I took a tour through Los Angeles one time, found out, saw where they lived, and, of course, was it their father? Somebody was murdered in that family.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Roger, what else should we be pointing out? What else can we talk about?
Well, I'd like to just finish it with, I write a column every other week called Points of Interest and Worthy Achievement. I've been doing this for, I think I've written 60 of them so far, every 2 weeks. There's so much going on in your community that is positive, and that's what that's what my column's about. It's to highlight people, what they're doing. I mean, you don't think about them unless you're exposed to them. I mean, how many people know what's going on at the care center? How many people know about Meals on Wheels? Oh, you know about it if you got a mother that happens to be on them.
Sure.
Or a grandmother or what have you. But the thing is, there's so many things going on, and that's what my column highlights, and is that there's good things going on at the school. There's good things going on in the city. I mean, many of times that we're very critical of people of success or people of position. You know, mayor, you know, someone said, you know, in Mount Ali, it's good to be mayor, but don't let it rain too much and flood the basements. Then you don't want to be mayor.
Not true.
And the same way with schools. You know, you want to be the leader of a school, but then you have a strike, or if you have grade scores come out that aren't very good, it's not too good to be that position. But there are so many things going out there, just not in the school, but in the community, if you think about them. You know, somebody told me recently, if you want to connect with the young people, you got to go to social media. If you want to talk to the older people, you got to do the local papers, because they're separated that way. Now, that's where you got to communicate. So we're in a time now, that's what we've got to do. I communicate, we'll say, I'm not much on Facebook or anything like that, but I communicate through the newspapers. And I think the people that are doing well, that are doing positive things, need to be recognized as such. And because there's so many of them out there. Monolith's very lucky. In their Meals on Wheels, which my wife is involved with scheduling on now, and I deliver Meals on Wheels too, but there's enough for different people every day. Think about that. In other towns, larger towns in Monolith, you don't see people enough people to do it. And you've got to have those people. Yeah. If nothing else, the Meals on Wheels not only feed the older people, they give them somebody to talk to. Very important. Sometimes they don't get anybody to talk to all day, you know. So those are big pluses. And I think if nothing else, and I'll finish with this, count your blessings. Count your blessings in your community. Try to do as much as you can to make your community better and let it rip from there.